I'm here with Joe Chapman. Joe Chapman is a graduate of Rochester University. He's also a belonger in the BVI, which is a very unusual status. We may get into that. He was also ranked number 97 on the world rankings of squash players, and he's now becoming a real estate guru. So, fascinating personality. I hope you enjoy this conversation with him. Joe.
Thanks, Guy.
So let's start with, I want to start with, tell me a little bit about growing up in the British Virgin Islands and how you ended up choosing Rochester University as the place to study.
So our parents took us to the British Virgin Islands when I was very small. And I ended up playing squash and surfing and doing every sport because it's a very outdoors kind of place, wakeboarding and surfing and sailing. And squash took my interest, and I played at a high level when I was a junior. And then the idea was to go get a scholarship to an American university. And so I went and traveled around to all the different universities, and University of Rochester was very strong at recruiting at that time, and they wanted to put together a team that could win the NCAA championship. And the year I got there, they were ranked about 35 in the country. And every year that I was there, we were in the top four, and we never won the NCAA championship, but we were around 2, 3, 4 each year.
And so you went to Rochester partly on the scholarship or because of the scholarship?
Yeah, and my interests changed dramatically when I went to the classes. And, you know, I didn't even know what major I was going to study. And then when I got there, I went to all different classes, philosophy and economics and political science and international relations and chemistry. For the first week, I just went to every single class. And then when I went to the economics class, there was a libertarian professor that was talking just so passionately. And I was like, this guy. And that was my major.
What was his name?
His name was Professor Mike Rizzo.
Okay.
And his job, he was hired by the University of Rochester to get people excited about economics.
You know, it's amazing, Joe, because I don't know if you realize that there's a journal of, I think it's called the Journal of Monetary Economics, and I remember because it had a kind of a pink cover. It was published by University of Rochester, and it was a pretty right-wing, in the economics world, it was a pretty right-wing journal when I used to read it. So I've never been to the University of Rochester, but that journal has I have a warm spot in my heart for that journal. When did you know that you would become a really good squash player? How did that come out?
I was quite late, so probably only when I was 16, 17, I took it really seriously. And then when I was at University of Rochester, our coach was a top four in the world player. And he took all of us kind of to the next level. And then you grow a lot between the ages of 18 and 22. And then when I was 22, my mom and dad were very supportive. They said, if you want to play professionally, this is the only chance you're going to have in your life. So why not take this chance?
Right. So where have you played in the world, and who have you played against for people who are into this world?
I've played in Brazil, China, Australia, New Zealand, all throughout Europe, a lot through North America. So pretty much all corners of the globe. And I've played all the top players as well, people that have been world number one, world champion.
Can you describe what does it feel like to break 100, I guess? Is that a big deal? And, I can imagine that moving up those ranks, going from 1,000th best player to 250 to 100, it's kind of like climbing one hell of a mountain. There must be some really difficult points along the way where you're deciding whether to continue or not.
But for me, or for a lot of people, I think the mindset has to be that you're going all the way to the top. So anything other than that it's kind of a disappointment. It's just like, yeah, I'm here, but I'm ready for the next level. You're always ready for the next level. And to get to the next level, you have to beat someone significantly better than you to keep climbing.
Right.
So never in my mind was I kind of content with where I was. I was always looking to get to the next level. And I decided to retire when I was 27 years old, and I was ranked around 97 to 100 right then. And it was just time to move on at that time.
You know, it's a pretty impressive achievement. I used to joke that I was in the top 1,000 in court tennis players, but that's because there are only about 1,000 court tennis players. And so you're certainly, of athletes that I know, probably the highest ranked athlete. And I think that I left a Vipassana retreat early just last year. I was supposed to go for 10 days. I left after 2 days. And my experience of quitting, it's really hard to quit something, even when I knew that it wasn't right for me to continue on that Vipassana retreat. It was not going to be a good experience for me. I was getting sick. I had other things going on. But you still get made to feel like a failure for quitting. And I think that it's a really important skill to learn that sometimes the best thing you can do for yourself is to quit, even though people are making you feel bad for it or the environment makes you feel bad, because you have to leave the place where you are. And there's kind of a lot around quitting that says, oh, you loser, you're quitting, before you can create the thing that's next, which shows that you can win again.
I think the truth is that nobody's actually thinking about you. Nobody really cares what you're doing. And you think more that other people are caring about you, but in reality, people are mostly thinking about themselves.
It's your own choice. So I remember quitting law, and I had 1 year to go, and people said, oh, you're mad, you should stay. And partly they didn't, you know, my quitting forced them to call into question why they were still doing it, because mm-hmm. they were as miserable as I was in my case with law. And so, I think it's a skill, and it shows a high degree of self-knowledge to be able to say, okay, what did you say you'd reached? It was time for you to go.
It was time to move on. And there was also, it coincided with Hurricane Irma in 2017.
Right.
So that decimated the Virgin Islands and all the houses that were there. So in the summer that we'd taken off from the off season, I was working with my brother in construction. That led into Hurricane Irma in September, and kind of our whole world changed a little bit then.
Yeah, so it created there was another reason for you to leave the squash world.
Yeah, and it felt bigger than, the hurricane felt bigger than myself, because there were so many people affected by it. 7 people died.
You knew?
From the BVI, I knew a few of them.
Wow, so it's a great segue. Now your email address is Chapman Property Group BVI.
So joe@cpgbvi.com. But yeah.
Exactly. And so presumably Chapman Property grew out of that. But tell us a little bit.
Yeah.
I've never lived through a hurricane. Mm-hmm. What was it like to live through the hurricane? I know that your family owns some properties. What is it like to see the properties get damaged or not? You know, we read about them in the news. What is it like to be in one?
At the time, it was incredibly devastating to have all your properties kind of damaged pretty badly. But not only that, the country was destroyed. The roads were pushed up and the telephone poles were down. And visually, aesthetically, very upsetting to see so much destruction.
Mm.
So at the time, very devastating. I didn't really think of it as a learning experience. But then years later, you look back at it and you say, wow, there's a lot to be learned about infrastructure there. And, you know, we could have built better. And we should have had the electrics going underground. We should have had better water system. We should have built our houses better. We should have bought more expensive windows. There's so many things. And so now we're more attuned to the tiny details and to see what the environment can do to the infrastructure that you live in, and how that infrastructure impacts your daily life, the relationships that you have, and your commute to work, what you do after work. And the built environment became even more interesting to me coming out of that experience.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what your strategy is in Chapman Property Group, and you know, what your investments have been, what your construction work has mm-hmm. been, how you've chosen those projects, what the results have been, why you chose the projects.
So we have 3 parts to the company. We have a construction company in which we can do work for other people as well. We have a asset ownership company where we are buying either distressed assets and we're fixing them up, or we're building from scratch ourselves and then we rent those out. And then the third part that we've just started is also buying stocks in public companies to do with infrastructure. So that's very new, that just came out of this pandemic, that we've been waiting to do for a while, but now we're building that position. We didn't have long after March before the stock market increased, but that's something that we're kind of experimenting with right now.
So,
but the core of the business, I would say, is the asset ownership. So we are looking to buy properties that are undervalued. We add to them, or we add value in some way, and we change the business model to increase the cash flow.
Yeah. And just in the BVI?
In the BVI. We're very, very focused on the market that we know and that we have a competitive advantage in.
Yeah.
Because I'm a BVI Islander, I have very specific advantages in which how quickly I can buy, or the contacts that I know in the country, and we're able to get higher rates of return because of that.
Yeah, it's if you're interested, the advantages that Joe Chapman has in the BVI just would make you salivate. And it's sort of like, you know, if you don't mind me diving into it, there are a bunch of absentee owners who mainly live in the United States and elsewhere, a small number of construction companies. The people who are absentee owners would get gouged if by those construction companies for all sorts of reasons. But if you're a local and you're there, you're not going to get gouged. Then over and above that, you have this lower stamp tax duty and mm-hmm. the right of preemption, which is it's just a whole bunch of advantages. It's just extraordinary. And it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds. I remember that when we visited you there, you took us to a marina which was used by the British Navy for the time that it was there to help stabilize the island. Mm. And I think that that was really a lesson for you in the power of good infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can describe that a little bit.
That's a very interesting marina. It's called Nanny Key, and it's an island that's on its own. So you have to cross a small bridge, maybe a 10-foot bridge, to get over to this island. But it makes it a community that's self-sustaining. They have their own desalination plant. They have their own generator. I believe they might even have their own Wi-Fi connection. So when the power went down in the entire country, that was one of the only places that was still functioning.
Yeah.
The military, very interestingly, strategically chose havens for themselves that were isolated, that had to cross a bridge to get to. Okay. So they were protected. So Nanny Key was one of those, and they had the plus of having all of that good infrastructure. Yeah.
I find it interesting that Nanny Key is a bit, I mean, obviously on a very different scale, but a bit like Manhattan in that it's an island, mm-hmm. But where you don't have to use a boat, you can cross with a bridge. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of control the island,
yeah.
But you have easy access onto the main island, basically.
That's 100% right. If you choose an island, the increase in the administration and the costs to get to that island from hiring barges and boats, makes it almost unattainable to run a business in the BVI anyway. So a lot of the islands are almost philanthropic or play assets of the rich and famous.
Yeah.
But to try to really run a business or make money, that's right. If you have a bridge to an isolated peninsula mm-hmm. that you can control, and that any addition that you add to it increases the value of the adjoining properties,
right.
Then you're in business.
So that's your dream, really.
So master plan communities is where my dream is. If you can buy 100 acres or 1,000 acres and you get to plan everything from, if it's apartments, if it's a marina, if it's condos, a hotel.
Right. I didn't realize that. So that's all so much fun, and mm-hmm. I've stayed in one of your villas, and it's extraordinarily well done. I was really impressed, and Joe showed me a couple more that I'm looking forward to visiting in the future. But you've decided, at least for now, not to be in the BVI. Can you explain a little bit about that decision?
So during the pandemic, the BVI has shut down a lot of its industry. There's very few flights in and out right now, and they're going for a strategy of zero cases. So I don't know how long this strategy will go on for, until there's a vaccine or until contact tracing or whatnot, but there's just not much going on there right now. So all of our villas that we usually rent to American tourists or visiting tourists to the island, we've put on a medium term to long term just to push over until the tourists start to come back. In that sense, there's not as much to do. So I took this opportunity to come to London and do my graduate degree, my master's in infrastructure, investment, and finance at the University College London.
And I'm really looking forward to, I actually am very interested to see all of the materials from your course. And maybe when you're there, I'll be able to come and visit. So last sort of a couple of questions. So you were talking about your ideas about the urban environment. What did you mean by that? What have you learned? What is important for the listener to learn from you in this case?
Well, from traveling, I got to see a lot of different ways that people live around the world. And I became very interested in architecture and urban planning and how people live. And there's actually a philosophy of living for each different country, from kind of Japan, maybe Hong Kong, Singapore, Houston. These are all such different makeups of how people live. And how do you create a high quality of life for yourself or create happiness for you and your family based on where you're living? How long is your commute time? Do you bike to work? Do you take a boat to work? Do you work close to your office? All of these influence how you live and how you build relationships with the people around you.
Which is your preferred model?
There's an interesting one that I think came from France originally called the 10-minute city. And it's imagine that there's a city and you walk 10 minutes from the center point of it, and then you draw a circle around that. And everything that you need to have in your life is within a 10-minute walk of anywhere in that city. So it's these concentric circles. I think it was developed in France a while ago. And I think that's a really interesting point. Probably the worst one is where you live in the suburbs. You get in your car and you drive on the highway for an hour to a group of offices or your mall, and you spend the day there and you get on the highway and you drive an hour back into the suburbs. I think that's probably the worst one. And if you wanted to look at a modern day country that's done really well, it's the ones that have incorporated walking spaces and bicycle paths. So it should be Scandinavia and Switzerland are probably the most successful, as well as Holland, in creating that kind of a low energy environment. If you think about it in terms of energy, a car uses a lot of energy and a bike uses less energy or walking.
I think that what you just described is in the worst case is Houston,
Houston,
actually.
exactly. I didn't want to say it. I didn't want Houston to make feel bad about themselves, but that is the worst.
And out of the ones that you described, you talk about Singapore, Japan, Hong Kong. Which out of specific places, which are the ones where you think they get it right?
Hong Kong is an incredibly interesting one because they have so much national park. So you don't you, everyone, when they think of Hong Kong, they think of millions of skyscrapers. It's actually not like that. It's very concentrated skyscrapers all in one place. And then you can take a cable car and go out and you're looking at nature for the vast majority. I don't know the percentage, but I think it's a high percentage of the island is actually national park. But in terms of the best country, in terms of their urban planning, I think Singapore has to be one of the best. Because they have a philosophy of renewal, they don't cherish any building as sacred, and each building can be knocked down to make room for the new growth. And the leader of the country, Lee Kuan Yew, even had his house, that his home that he grew up in, upon his death, was to be ordered to be knocked down, so that it wasn't going to be turned into a museum.
That's extraordinary. And I have, so this is really is, I think, the last question. I now, we're conducting this conversation in London, and I've spent the last 10 years living in Switzerland, and I love Switzerland. I don't know the Scandinavian countries or Netherlands as well, but I just wish that I could have the Swiss teach the Brits and the Americans a little bit about how to create a better urban environment, how to do better public transportation. And I think that, this guy Tyler Brûlé of Monocle has been working hard at that with his magazine. Do you think there's any way, do you think we have any hope, those of us who've had the opportunity to see how things could be, to teach? I mean, I think the two major Anglo-Saxon countries, the United States and the UK, have so much to learn from those countries but don't seem to want to learn.
So one of the difficulties is that the stakeholders are already entrenched in society. So you've got a mixture of private and public already in established cities. So if you look at master plan communities, it's the only opportunity for one entrepreneur to say to himself, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to do it differently. But if you were to come into a city like London and say you wanted to do it this way, you would have organizations that oppose you and make it very difficult.
Yeah. Actually, a great example of that, I haven't studied it very well, but it makes an enormous amount of sense to put a new airport for London into the Thames estuary, build an island, Dubai style, put all the runways you want, have a 24-hour airport. It would be the most incredible airport. You could take Heathrow and turn it into a secondary airport or a private airport or a military airport or something. But so many stakeholders. And Heathrow is prime British real estate in the west of the country, some of the highest value real estate. And what they wanted to do is build a third runway. I don't know where it is right now, but that was entrenched interest. So that makes an enormous amount of sense for me and doesn't bode particularly well for the future of London planning wise. But so that leads on to another question before we get to the end of this. So you've explained, and I now understand the benefits of master planned communities. Tell me, I'm now aware that the Irvine Company in Irvine, California has done an extraordinary job, and it's where my Indian friend Monish Pabrai lives, and I've been cycling with him there, and there's some things that are extraordinary, although it's a little spread out for me, but so be it. Tell me about, can you talk now about other master planned communities?
Well, the Irvine Ranch is one of the best ones, and this was Donald Brenn, has basically chosen one tract of land, I believe a huge tract of land, tens of thousands of acres, around Orange County, and decided this is going to be my life's work. It's his tapestry to paint, so to say. And he's done gorgeous natural wildlife and golf courses and houses and condos and hotels. And I think every year it's voted one of the best places to live.
Yeah, it's also an unusual conservative enclave within California, which is primarily Democrat. I have to say it's really lovely, although a little bit boring is what I would say.
I've never actually been there, but I've just researched a lot about it. And the US has a lot of master plan communities, in fact. And
which entrepreneurs should one follow?
Well, the Howard Hughes Corporation is another one that has, I believe, five throughout the United States. And their major investor is Bill Ackman, who's taken an even bigger stake in the economic downturn. And that's one that I've researched in quite a bit of depth and one that I would like to replicate in the future.
Right. Where?
Well, my greatest knowledge is in the British Virgin Islands. Yeah.
So it would be getting something like Nanny Key, because that's effectively a master plan community.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, I mean, this is a tiny scale in comparison to what we're talking about.
Who cares? It's still pretty cool. Huh?
What we're talking about is hundreds of thousands of acres, and the ones in the BVI, that could only be 30 or 50 acres.
Yeah.
But you have to start somewhere. And the way to make it work really profitably in the BVI is to incorporate the ocean into it through a marina, through selling services through boats, and then you can kind of build on that with hotels and amenities and beaches.
Wonderful. I've learned something. I do realize that I've learned something. This is so much fun. That is the point of this, is not to create some show and have lots of viewers, but for me to get the opportunity to drill down on something. And it's really fun, because I don't know if I would have gotten you to explain this much if we'd just been strolling around talking about other stuff. So I really appreciate that. Joe, last question. If somebody wants to get in touch with you and engage with you on any of these issues, what is the best way to get in touch with you?
You can send me an email at joe@cpgbvi.com, and I'd be more than happy to engage with anyone and talk about the Virgin Islands or talk about development or the philosophy of the built environment in any way, because this is going to be my life's work.
Joe, do you have a Twitter account?
I don't have any social media like that to follow me, but the best way is just to email me or find my phone number online and give me a call.
You probably just Google Joe, but I'll be convincing Joe to get a Twitter account because you'll be blown away by how powerful it was. Joe, thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Thank you, Guy.